You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this episode is presented by Emma Louise Fenelon.
In September this year, Mohammed Al-Fayed, the former owner of Harrods, was added to the list of powerful men accused of serious sexual crimes, following a BBC documentary containing testimony from more than 20 female ex-employees. That number has since mushroomed to hundreds of women with allegations that include surveillance of phone lines, intrusive medical tests, threats and intimidation, and a pattern of predatorial behaviour that included sexual assault and rape. Reading about the accounts of Mr. Al-Fayed's victims, aside from feeling disgusted at the abuse his victims suffered and heartened at the bravery of the women speaking out publicly about their appeal, had me thinking, as one does, about the law on vicarious liability and where it stands today after significant development in the last decade or so. Now, long-time listeners to this podcast will recognise my guest today, Isabel McArdle, who has previously spoken about topics as wide-ranging as Henry VIII powers, taxation, and actions against the police. And along with Rob Keller KC, Isabel appeared on one of our very popular episodes in 2020, speaking about two recent Supreme Court cases on vicarious liability handed down on the same day. And I'm delighted that Isabel has agreed to join me to update us on vicarious liability. Isabel, you are very welcome back to LawPod UK.
Thanks, Emma. It's great to be here.
So can you remind us, for those practicing in this area and possibly not practicing in this area, what is vicarious liability and why is it essential to anyone working in civil law?
So it's the basic concept that if a wrong, an act or omission, a tort, is committed by a person when that person is working for somebody else, the person who's been harmed by that wrong can bring a claim against the somebody else, the employer, typically, who has benefited from the work of their employee or something close to an employee, and harm has been caused through that. And it's really important because there can be all sorts of reasons why you want to pursue the employer, but typically it's because they tend to be insured, they tend to have deeper pockets, they're not uncommonly easier to find as a defendant than perhaps an individual who might have moved on, might be untraceable, you might not even know who they are. So it's a very important concept that allows people who've been harmed because an employer or someone close to an employer has sent out someone else into the world to do their business, resulting in an injury to an individual.
Well, so those familiar with this area of law will know that, and to borrow now oft-repeated words, has been on the move for some time. When you spoke with Rob Keller 4 years ago now about vicarious liability, you reminded us that this area of law has in fact stemmed from medieval times. We're not going to go all the way back there today, but I was wondering, can you tell us how it has developed as an area more recently?
Yeah, absolutely. It starts with masters and servants, and I think we probably don't need to go back that far. That's interesting for students of legal history. But in the last, well, since the millennium, and particularly in the last decade or so, there's been a lot of activity in the higher courts, especially the Supreme Court, exploring what are really the two big questions that arise in vicarious liability. So the first one of those two questions is, does the wrongdoer, so the employee or quasi-employee, meet the test of being an employee or being sufficiently close to it that it's enough for the courts to say, okay, this is the type of relationship between employer, quasi-employer, and employee or quasi-employee that we will say, yes, the vicarious liability in play here. And of course, if it is an employer-employee relationship, then there's no problem with that. That test is satisfied. But it's people who are not meeting the definition of having a contract of employment, but are doing something that looks a lot like it, where that question arises and where there's been lots of interesting recent development. And the second big question that, again, the Supreme Court in particular, but other courts too, have been exploring a lot in the last decade or so is, well, is the act or the omission, the wrongdoing, something that the employer, quasi-employer, should be liable for? Because, of course, not everything that even someone who is an employee does is something their employer will be liable for. Things happening in their private life, unless there are some very unusual circumstances, are very unlikely to be something which the employer is liable for. Things which they do in the course of an ordinary day in employment, deploying their duties, are commonly going to be things which the employer is liable for. But there's a grey area. How closely connected to what they're employed to do does the act or omission have to be in order to give rise to vicarious liability? So those are really the two questions. Number one is the relationship one, where vicarious liability can be in play. And number two is the act or omission one, where the employer or quasi-employer should be vicariously liable if the facts are all made out.
Okay, and so if we look at the first of those questions, who can an employer or quasi-employer be liable for if you are not an employee under a formal contract of employment?
So this is a question that was explored in a case that's often called the Christian Brothers case, various claimants and Catholic Child Welfare Society. It's just over 10 years old, but that went all the way to the Supreme Court and really explored this question, because the factual background gave rise to some difficult questions about it. It featured a school, and there were brothers, members of a defendant institute, so essentially a religious society they were members of, this institute. And they worked in the school to provide a Christian education on behalf of the institute. And sadly, sexual abuse took place between some of the brothers and some of the children. But they weren't employees. They were members of a religious order. They had taken vows, like a vow of chastity and a vow to obey their superiors. They were paid, but they didn't take that money. It went straight to a charitable trust for the benefit of the institute. And their needs, in turn, were met by the institute far more than the average employer. So they were accommodated on the school grounds as a consequence of being brothers and their relationship with the institute. They obviously were fed and such like by the institute. So the question arose of whether or not that was a close enough relationship. And it was particularly important on the facts that the institute got to choose who the head teacher was of the school. And then that head teacher, in turn, chose which of the brothers were going to be teachers. So there was a very high degree of control by the institute as to who got to be in the school and what job they did. And the Supreme Court said that there is essentially a five-stage test to examine when considering whether or not there is a sufficient relationship between quasi-employer and quasi-employee, such that we're close enough that this should be treated as potentially a relationship giving rise to vicarious liability. Not all elements of that test are necessarily equally important, and certainly in every case, but stage one is the employer is more likely to have the means to compensate the victim than the employee and can be expected to have insured against it. Stage two, that the tort, the wrongdoing, will have been committed as a result of activity being taken by the employee on behalf of the employer. And I think that's really critical. So it can't be someone inspired by somebody else. It has to be an individual, or I suppose a legal person, but normally an individual, who is acting, doing the business or forwarding the mission, acting in accordance with the purpose of the employer, but on their behalf, not just, as I say, inspired by or moved by or motivated by something that someone else has as a name of their own. Thirdly, the employee's activity has to be part of the business activity, the employer, which of course is a very similar point. It doesn't necessarily have to be a commercial business as such, a profit-making business, but essentially the activity has to be part of fulfilling that purpose that the employer or the quasi-employer has. Fourth, the employer, by employing the employee to carry on the activity, has to have created the risk of the tort committed by the employee. So it can't just be that by chance that risk arises. It has to be something which comes about because of the structure or the organization or the business that the employee has created. And fifthly, importantly, the employee will, to a greater or lesser degree, have been under the control of the employer. So that one obviously is critical. There has to be a significant degree or sufficient degree of control in order for the employer to be treated as an employer as opposed to simply having some other relationship that's not enough. So on the facts, of course, it was made out because there was an incredibly high degree of control. If anything, there was, as I said earlier, there was much more control of the brothers by the Institute than a normal employee-employer relationship. You know, the Institute had decided that they had to take a vow of chastity. You know, employers don't normally require their employees to do that. It controlled what happened to their money. It fed them. It did things which would be even closer related than a normal employee-employer relationship. And so those were really compelling factors that meant that on the facts of that case, even though we didn't have the conventional contract of employment, there was plenty there to allow the Supreme Court to say, yes, this is the kind of relationship that ticks the necessary boxes.
I can certainly see how Christian Brothers, who were essentially taking the role of teachers, would meet that test and fulfill most of, if not all of, the five stages laid out in that case, given that teachers in ordinary employment by a local education authority would. But are there any other recent examples in circumstances where a listener might be more surprised that the test was made out?
Yeah, absolutely. There's some really interesting, fairly recent examples. There's a Supreme Court case from a few years back called Cox and Ministry of Justice that was all about prisoner working in a prison kitchen. So this person was paid and wasn't under a conventional contract of employment, because working in the prison is part and parcel of the Ministry of Justice fulfilling its public law duties, I suppose, of rehabilitation. It's obliged to provide prisoners with the opportunity to work. It isn't like a normal employer who can simply choose who they want or don't want to work for them, subject obviously to discrimination and such like. But it was a different relationship. It wasn't an employment relationship. And what happened on the facts was that the prisoner was helping carry some very big, I think, bags of rice, very heavy bags of rice. One of them splits and some of the rice ends up on the floor. And he's told, stop moving other bags of rice until we've dealt with the, I guess, slipping hazard caused by this spilt rice. And he ignores that, ends up dropping a great big bag of rice on someone else who gets injured. And so the question was, well, is the relationship between the Ministry of Justice that has, after all, provided him with this opportunity to work and pays him, is that enough to amount to the sort of relationship that's sufficiently close to employment as to give rise to vicarious liability? And the answer was, well, yes, fundamentally, because the operation of the prison, something the Ministry of Justice was responsible for, which included cooking and feeding the other prisoners, and possibly staff as well, but certainly the prisoners, that was a fundamental part of the, if you like, business activity, to use the Christian Brothers expression, of the Ministry of Justice. Its function, its role when it set up a prison was you've got to operate it, you've got to feed everybody in it as well as other things. And so in using prisoners to work in the kitchen, there was not only control and such like, but there was fundamental integration into the very business activity of the Ministry of Justice. And therefore, having furthered its aims and such like by working in that way, the prisoner was someone for whom the Ministry of Justice could be vicariously liable.
And if I'm right in thinking that there was another case where integration played an important role, and I'm thinking now of the case of Arms, can you tell us a little bit about that case and why that case might surprise some of our listeners in terms of how vicarious liability was made out?
It's another really interesting example, actually, because it concerned the question of whether a local authority that was responsible as a matter of public law for placing children with foster parents, whether it could be vicariously liable where the foster parents sexually abused the children in their care. And at first blush, the casual observer might think, well, that seems like a very different situation, both from the Christian Brothers situation where there was so much everyday control and such like. But actually, there was vicarious liability made out. There was the possibility that that could be made out. The relationship was sufficient. And the reasons for that were because there was a high degree of control. And we have to step back and think about what that means in this case, because you might think, well, the parents choose, the foster parents are choosing when the kids get up, you know, what clothes they wear, what they eat, what, where they go on a Saturday and such like. They have the day-to-day, everyday life control of the children, and they aren't told by the local authority, you must make sure on Saturday afternoon all the kids go to the park or something of that nature. They have ordinary, everyday control of that family life. But there were other very important elements of control that the local authority had, which gave rise to a sufficient relationship for vicarious liability. So, for example, they obviously had powers to approve or not approve of certain people to be foster parents. They inspected. They did engage in a degree of supervision. And, of course, they could remove children if they felt that the foster parents weren't doing a good job or for some other reason, like there was some better place for the children to be, which you would never get in normal family life. So while the situation may have had the veneer of being far removed from an employer-employee relationship, there was sufficient control and other factors there, such as obviously having deeper pockets and forwarding the aims of the local authority, essentially engaging in their quote-unquote business activity, because of course it's not a business, but their activity of ensuring these children were looked after and such like, that the foster parents were people for whom the local authority could be vicariously liable. Again, the relationship was sufficiently ticking the boxes, the five factors outlined in Christine Brothers, that it met the test.
So we know that liability may arise in circumstances where harm is caused by prisoners working in a prison or members of a religious order engaged in educating children or even foster parents. But what are the limits? Or put another way, when will the test not be satisfied?
Again, this is something that the Supreme Court's looked at quite recently in the Barclays Bank case. So in the Barclays Bank case, the bank was interested in employing people to work in its banks. And as part of the application process of being vetted to take up a job there, it used a doctor called Dr. Bates, with whom it contracted for that doctor to write reports, having examined each potential employee and to obviously assess whether they were medically fit for the job. That was a situation where the Supreme Court said, there's no vicarious liability here because we don't have all the Christian Brothers type tests being met. We don't have a sufficiently strong overlap with a true employment situation because of factors like, fundamentally, Dr. Bates was engaging in his own business in offering to provide these reports for a fee. You know, he could refuse to do it. He had his own insurance. It was his own activity. It may have assisted the bank, but not in a fundamentally different way from if the bank had contracted with an independent contractor to clean its windows or decorate its hallways. There was sufficient lack of control. There was sufficient independent enterprise by Dr. Bates. He really was engaging in his own business that the vicarious liability test couldn't be satisfied there in relation to the relationship between potentially quasi-employer and potentially quasi-employee.
Okay, so then if we've established a quasi-employment relationship, going back to the two questions that you described at the beginning of the episode, will any connection between the wrongdoing and the employment or quasi-employment be enough for vicarious liability to be established? And can you speak a little bit about that second question that the Supreme Court has looked at in recent years?
Absolutely. So this is a really interesting question of how close to the duties which an employee, or I'm going to use the term employee, but please understand that might be quasi-employee as well, but which an employee is employed to undertake, does the act or the omission that is the wrong which someone else wants to bring a claim about because they've been harmed by it, how close does that have to be to the duties the person's employed for in order for vicarious liability to lie? Because it's not enough just to be an employee or a quasi-employee. You also have to be doing, or in an omission case, not doing something that the law recognises as it being fundamentally fair for the employer to be liable for. So ordinarily, you might be incredibly conventionally employed, but you, in your spare time, go and commit a tort. So what about your employment? Your employer isn't responsible for things you do in your own time. on your own initiative. But there have been two Supreme Court cases fairly recently in the last 10 years that have explored the margins of grey area there between things you just do on your own in your free time and things you're doing at work or because work gave you the opportunity. It's very difficult in some cases to draw the line between what is and is not going to be sufficiently closely connected. So strangely enough, both of these cases feature as the employer, the Morrison supermarket chain. Very, very strange coincidence, but there we are. So the first one is called Muhammad, and Mr. Muhammad, on the facts, he went to a petrol station that was operated by the Morrison supermarket chain, and there was an employee there, Mr. Khan. And essentially, Mr. Muhammad makes a customer inquiry, just asks if they can perform a particular service. And Mr. Khan, the employee, responds with really terrible language, including racist language, tells the customer to leave. The customer then goes out to his car, parked on the forecourt of the petrol station, is chased by the employee, Mr. Khan, and ends up being very seriously assaulted by Mr. Khan there on the forecourt. Astonishing set of facts, but that's what happens. And of course, Mr. Khan is at work when this is happening, is on duty, probably wearing uniform, but you know, it's very much supposed to be in that place, the petrol station, supposed to be responding to customers' inquiries. But of course, not unreasonably, perhaps, Morrison Supermarket said, well, that may be true, but there's no part of your job working in the petrol station that involves you being racist or being violent to a customer. That's absolutely outside of anything we would ever have authorised you to do. And you know, there was no doubt that that was the case. Of course, Morrison's hadn't wanted any of those activities to take place. And the Supreme Court, in fact, found that vicarious liability was established. The acts were sufficiently closely connected to the employment so as to allow vicarious liability to arise. And the reasons for that were that essentially they examined the very specific circumstances in which the employee committed the tort and found that they were within what was termed the field of activities assigned to him. In particular, you know, essentially his job was to respond to customer inquiries. And he was responding to a customer inquiry when he verbally and physically assaulted the customer, even if he was doing so in a way that was obviously completely and totally unlike how the employer wanted him to be responding to the customer inquiry. It was not how I'm sure he was trained to do it, but he was fundamentally doing his job, albeit doing it in an incredibly incorrect way. And one of the important points that the Supreme Court touched upon, which gets slightly modified in the second case, is the question of what is the motive behind what's being done. And the Supreme Court says, well, it wasn't something personal between them. It was an order to keep away from the employer's premises. It was reinforced by violence. In giving such an order, he was purporting to act about his employer's business. It was a gross abuse of his position, but it was in connection with the business in which he was employed to serve customers. And there's even a passage saying that motive is irrelevant, but as I say, that gets a bit modified or explored further in the second case. So the second Morrison's case is from just a few years after. Again, this one gets to the Supreme Court and it's Morrison supermarkets and various claimants. And in this case, it's a rather different sort of job that the employee was doing. And Mr. Skelton was a senior internal auditor. And as part of his job, he receives payroll data for a work purpose. He has to send that payroll data out to external auditors. So he handles payroll data, an everyday part of what he does. That's one of his duties, and he's supposed to do a particular thing with it, to send it to a particular firm, probably. Yes, it was a firm. But he uses the opportunity, his access to this very sensitive data, to copy it without permission. And he happens, by way of background, to have a grudge against this employer. There'd been some disciplinary proceedings against him, and he felt very aggrieved by the fact that there'd been these disciplinary proceedings against him. And he copies it. He then distributes his personal data in completely unauthorized ways, so makes it public in various ways. And claimants who are individuals whose data is leaked in this way bring various claims for breach of confidence. And the Supreme Court lands on the other side of the line in this case compared to in the Muhammad and Morrison's case. It finds that there isn't essentially a sufficiently close connection between the deliberate acts, the wrongdoing here, and the very duties that Mr. Skelton was employed to undertake. And they make the point that, well, they recognise that the opportunity arose because he was there working on the computers, getting access to this very sensitive data as part of his role. But that wasn't enough. And critical was the capacity in which he was acting when the events that were the tortious events took place. He wasn't purporting to act on the employer's business. In fact, he was purporting really to do the opposite. He was doing it because of his grudge, his grievance against Morrison's. He was trying to harm Morrison's by leaking this data in this way. And they contrast it with the earlier Morrison's case, the Mahaban Morrison's case. So Mr. Khan, that's the petrol station employee, they say, was going, albeit wrongly, about his employer's business rather than pursuing his private ends. Whereas in contrast, they note that Mr. Skelton was not engaging in furthering his employer's business. On the contrary, he was pursuing a personal vendetta, seeking vengeance for the disciplinary proceedings some months earlier. As a consequence of that, what he did, his wrongful conduct, wasn't sufficiently closely connected that vicarious liability could arise. So it's obviously critical to look at what are the person's duties, what their contracts say, and what is the everyday way in which their job works, because not everything's written down in your contract. And of course, if something falls into that pot, then provided you've got the right relationship first, you're going to have vicarious liability arising. But if the person's duties aren't clear about this act or omission, and if in fact they are acting for some motivation which is not their employer's, don't think it has to be diametrically opposed to their employer's, but it is not furthering the business of the employer, then vicarious liability is not going to lie. But I would say that sounds all very well and good, but applying it in practice is not that easy. So I do think it could be that the outcome of the second Morrison's case, various claimants where it's Mr. Skelton who has stolen the data and wrongly published it, it could have gone the other way, because you could say, well, part and parcel of his job was handling this personal data. It was fundamentally something which he had access to, and sending it out to, as it happens, external auditors was what he was employed to do. And he was sending it out, albeit he was sending it out to someone else when he committed the tort. But I think in most cases, it is reasonably easy is the wrong word, but it is possible to work out where the line is likely to lie, because fundamentally, Mr. Skelton's motives were of critical importance, and he wasn't trying to or purporting to be acting on behalf of the employer. Whereas Mr. Khan was responding to a customer inquiry. He really was doing the very thing he was employed to do, but he was doing it in a catastrophically incorrect way. And so the question always is this, you know, why is the person doing this? Is this really purporting to act on behalf of the employer? And that isn't always going to be an easy question.
I think one of the helpful cases that it may be useful to touch upon briefly is the most recent treatment by the Supreme Court of this issue in Trustees of the Barry Congregation of Jehovah's Witnesses and BXB. And I think it's certainly worth listeners reading that case. One of the things that it illustrates is how tricky this issue is, because if you look back at the decision at first instance and also at the Court of Appeals stage, the Supreme Court went a different way from both of those decisions. Some might say we're quite critical of those decisions, but it's an example, isn't it, of how reasonable minds, well-informed minds, may differ on some of these crucial questions.
Liam, and again, it's a case where it wouldn't necessarily be obvious to even the informed observer at the outset how that one would end. It was a case where there was an elder, so a sort of senior, not an employee, but a person put into a fairly senior position in a religious congregation who engaged in a sort of flirtatious relationship with one of the members of the congregation. That person was uncomfortable and even raised it with somebody else, another elder, who said, oh, you know, the first elder is going through a difficult time, give that person support. And so the member of the congregation continued to engage in a non-sexual relationship, a friendship or something akin to that, with the elder and then was raped in the elder's home. But no vicarious liability was made out, not because being the elder didn't meet the relationship test, didn't tick that first box. Being put into the position of an elder was sufficiently close to employment that Christian Brothers' test would have been satisfied, just because, for example, the elder wasn't paid, that didn't matter. But there wasn't a sufficiently close connection between being put into the position of an elder and committing a very serious sexual crime in your own home, in your own time. And I think it does illustrate the size of that grey area, because he only had the relationship with a member of the congregation, the non-sexual relationship before the sex crime, because he was an elder. So he had the opportunity. He was only able to develop that relationship because of being given that opportunity by the quasi-employer. The claimant, the injured party, would not have continued to engage in essentially a friendship with this elder if not encouraged by another elder of the religious congregation. But all of those connections and all of those perhaps but four steps weren't sufficient, because there was no part of his quasi-employment that required the elder who committed the tort to have this member of the congregation in his home. It would probably be very different if it had happened at, say, a prayer group, as that was wrapping up in a building that was owned by or operated by the religious body. But because it was sufficiently far removed from really anything that the elder was placed in that position to do, it wasn't enough. But you're absolutely right. It's a great example of just how difficult and unpredictable this area can be.
Bringing our discussion back to clinical negligence, one of the things that strikes me is that the pool of potential defendants is so much wider in the modern world, where so much of healthcare is outsourced and maybe provided by subcontracted private companies, and how that can make it more difficult to discern exactly who a defendant is and whether or not any sort of quasi-employment may give rise to vicarious liability. What's your take on how practitioners should approach some of those knotty questions?
Oh gosh, that could be a whole other talk. So it's an incredibly difficult question. I think for claimants, there is often a huge difficulty in identifying who the right defendant is in the modern world, as you say, because of contracting out, because of shared care between different bodies. In the private healthcare world, commonly you might have a consultant surgeon who, at least as a matter of contract, is an independent contractor, but is working in the private healthcare provider's hospital, working with people who are genuinely employees, like nursing staff that tend to be. And a really difficult question. And I think all I can say is be very familiar with the law of vicarious liability. Keep an eye on how it's moving on. Always ask to have a look at contractual documents early on, because if the contract is enough to establish employment or something close enough to it, then, you know, bingo, we don't have to get too engaged in the Christian Brothers type test. And just start your investigation as early as you can, because these questions can be very difficult and you don't want to be grappling with them when you're hard up against a limitation deadline if you're for a claimant. Obviously, if you're for a defendant, well, there are these questions too, because it might be a fundamental part of your defence as to whether or not you are the right defendant. And so again, really similar questions arise. Is this really some individual where you have an employment relationship? Is the relationship really sufficiently close to amount to employment? Is the act something which could be argued falls outside of the sufficiently close connection test or the omission because it doesn't take place in your premises, because it doesn't forward any of your objectives, because it doesn't neatly fall into one of the duties that you've assigned to this individual?
Isabel, that's so helpful, certainly to me, but also I'm sure to many of our listeners. And we will, as we always do, link to all of the cases mentioned in today's episode. And we will also link to the episode that you did with Rob Keller, so that if anyone wants to go back and hear more about, for example, the medieval history to this area of law, they can do. I certainly enjoyed re-listening to it last night. But all that remains for me to do is to say thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully we will have you back again.
Fantastic. Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed it.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenelon. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row.